The planet's in a mess, but David Bollier has a solution. He wants us to think like commoners.
To think like a commoner is to realize that you can meet your needs by developing the relationships with others who are similarly situated. Devise the systems for protecting those interests over time. It's about stewardship of the resource and your community, not private property and ownership.
We'll talk with Bollier about his new book, Think Like a Commoner. But the commons economy isn't the only way to help communities. So can the market, if it's in the form of investing in local and sustainable businesses. Michael Schumann says that's good for communities and investors.
The key sweet spot for a local investor is to put their money into well-established local businesses with strong, steady growth.
Schumann's book is Local Dollars, Local Cents. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Earth Day 2014 just went by. With the recently published IPCC reports on climate, we've been duly warned about the direness of our existential predicament on this planet. Environmental breakdown is hitting us now, and it's hitting us hard, and we've only got 15 years to turn it around. But finding solutions takes more than knowing how bad it is. After all, Martin Luther King said he had a dream. He didn't say, I have a nightmare. Dreams inspire. Nightmares can paralyze. Or maybe to act, we need to first acknowledge the nightmare and then open a space for the dream. So this Earth Day week, instead of gloom and doom, we'll talk with two people who have a dream. In the second half of the show, we'll hear about the growing movement for local sustainable investing, a movement that could save Main Street by bypassing Wall Street. But first, we talk again with longtime guest David Bollier about his dream, one he's been working to make real for many years, the shift to a worldwide commons economy that will steward the Earth's resources, not deplete them. His latest book, Think Like a Commoner, reimagines an economy ruled by sharing and self-reliance, of markets beyond predatory capitalism, of a way of life that takes care of the long-term needs of both humans and the planet. Think Like a Commoner offers more than a blueprint. It offers a lens to see the world in a different way.
We have been living in a market culture for the past 200 years, but especially in the past 30 years since the neoliberalism of Reagan-Thatcher took hold, that we almost have trouble seeing that we're imprisoned in a certain perspective and worldview which privileges the individual as if the individual had nothing to do with a community or with nature, and presumes that private property and market transactions are the only way that we can meet our needs in the world. So talking about the commons is a way to extricate ourselves from really this mental prison and to begin to entertain some different perspectives that assert our common humanity and our ability to cooperate to solve problems and meet our needs.
And actually, this is a very old way. I mean, the market is fairly new in terms of a way to meet our needs. We don't have to go very far back to the commons of New England towns, but, you know, the whole of human history was mostly with this point of view of the commons. Tell us about the commons. You were on an airplane flight, and somebody asked you, your seatmate asked you what you do, and you started to explain to her. Tell us, what did you tell her, and then how did she respond?
Well, it's always kind of a conversation stopper, because I can't say an ordinary occupation. I am a commons advocate and scholar, and I've been doing this since the late 1990s. And so it's always a bit of a challenge when somebody asks that. But I've learned to explain, well, are you familiar with the Boston Common? Are you familiar with New England Commons? Perhaps you know of shared resources like parks or urban spaces. And essentially, the woman responded and got it immediately, as commons are things that are not really owned by any individual, but they are collectively essential to us all. And we need to have means for managing those resources, because without them, the air, the internet, scientific research, cultural inheritance, we're lost. And the commons is really about finding new ways to both name these shared resources and then to devise systems, either social or public policy systems, to manage them for our ongoing benefit. Because really we have an obligation to convey these shared resources that we inherit to future generations in at least as good a shape as we found them. So this woman next to me started saying, oh, well, we have a farmer's market in our town, or there's a park where we walk our dogs, and all of us are sort of very protective of each other and of the park. Well, she was beginning to understand what a commons is and to, in my terms, think like a commoner.
When you mention a park, a public park, you introduce the idea that public has something to do with the commons. Talk a little bit about that, and also what you talk about in your book, David Bollier, and Thinking Like a Commoner, of the changing nature of the relationship between the private sphere and the public sphere.
Well, in traditional political culture, we have things that are public and things that are private. And government manages the public, and the market and private property manages the private. But the commons really shatters that dualism and asserts that there's a new third category that takes a little bit of both. And if you think of something like the maker movement, or where people have workspaces that they share together, it's sort of like a club, but it's not as exclusive as a club because people are welcome so long as they respect the rules that the community has established. So really a commons is about collective meaning-making and self-organized rules as opposed to bureaucracies handing down rules from on high, or people with private property or markets asserting that money and property rights will govern things. Commons are about self-organized governance and rulemaking for resources that we love and need. And so people in a park is not necessarily a commons until people get together and say, well, these are the rules that make sense to us that meet our needs, which may or may not be the same thing that the municipal government asserts is necessary. So the commons really carves out this new space for understanding and reclaiming the resources that matter to us.
So People's Park in 1967 in San Francisco, in Berkeley, California, would have been a commons.
The problem has been that over the past two generations, ever since this famous or infamous 1968 essay called The Tragedy of the Commons by Garrett Hardin, people have assumed that a commons is a failed management regime, that the tragedy of the commons was a fable about a pasture in which no individual has a rational incentive for holding back and not using the commons, and therefore it is overexploited and ruined, the so-called tragedy of the commons. Well, this has been disproved by many empirical studies, most notably by Eleanor Ostrom, who won the Nobel Prize in 2009, showing that there are many, many commons across the world and history in which resources can be sustainably protected and managed over time without being ruined. So that's really the core challenge of the commons, is to devise those systems for ensuring that there are not free riders or people who are abusing the commons and protecting it so that it's accessible for everyone.
So it's actually the market in a way that sabotages that, because as long as people were aware of the commons, they took care of it. But when the market came in, this whole understanding became eroded.
Well, at one time, markets were subservient to communities, and communities were able to assert the terms by which markets operated so that there were certain basic ethical, ecological, and social norms that governed. But one could argue that over the past 150 years, or especially the past 30 years, when the regulatory state has been sabotaged by free marketeers, the Reagan-Thatcher world that we've come to know, which has resulted in, for example, the 2008 financial crisis, since this occurred, the means for making sure the market remained ecologically responsible and socially responsive have eroded The regulatory state has been, I think, a failure, and we have some rather cataclysmic issues to deal with, like climate change, precisely because of the tragedy of the market is not being arrested by the state. The state itself has been compromised. So I see the commons as a way to start to reassert these values and to innovate with new systems to protect our shared resources, be they ecological or digital or social.
And you have many instances in the book. One of the first is, and I know I'm going to mispronounce the name, the women of Erakulapali, a small village in Hyderabad, India. Talk about what they did, how they rediscovered the commons of their ancestors.
Well, this was a very moving experience for me, where I was at a conference in Hyderabad, India, and we went 2 hours into the rural area to meet with these women who... they had once been bonded laborers on a landlord's farm, and they really could only afford enough for one meal a day, and they were often quite hungry. But then they came up with the idea of recovering the traditional seeds that their grandmothers and had used before the Green Revolution. And these seeds were more ecologically suited to the semi-arid region than the often proprietary GMO seeds that Monsanto and the likes had brought in. And they rediscovered these seeds and started to plant them, and they became commoners on their own land and were able to be self-sustaining. Now, conventional economists would say, this is not an advance. They're not trading in the market. They're not creating GDP, gross domestic product. But in fact, their subsistence commoning with land that they owned themselves or were able to acquire and could improve was an alternative means for meeting their own needs. And they owned their own seeds, which they could use and share among each other. And so this was an instance where it's a non-market, non-governmental solution that allowed them to increase their health and livelihood, because they could eat two meals a day, without being dependent on a very volatile, fickle global market for food, where, you know, if some country halfway across the world undercuts the price of a certain agricultural commodity, that community is destitute. So the commons is really, it becomes a means for self-reliance, sustainability, stepping away from the predations and vagaries of the global market.
Yesterday, I was talking with Michael Schumann, who was the founder of Business Alliance for a Local Living Economy. He's come out with a new book, which we will be talking about on this show, about local economies. You point out that the commons is also a way to revitalize the local economy. I wonder if you could talk about how that happens first, and then I'm going to ask you a little bit about how it can integrate a little bit with a local market.
Well, just as the commons provides us with an alternative vision for development besides the one that neoliberal capitalism has put forward for years and years, the commons is also a different vision of local control and self-determination, because once again, you're not ceding control to absentee investors or property owners or impersonal markets that really don't care anything about your community except for what can be extracted for those markets. So the commons starts to say, we want to be self-reliant, we want to help our neighbors, sometimes through the market, but our community needs long-term take priority. So the commons becomes a way for reimagining markets beyond capitalism. It doesn't necessarily do away with markets, but it does domesticate them and make them socially responsive in ways that they just are not now. And I think the local food movement is really at the vanguard of a lot of these efforts to bring back native foods, which have often been lost to processed foods from the agricultural food sector. It's a way of bringing back cross-dependencies between farmers and consumers and other suppliers of the agricultural world in a way that the entire community becomes more stable and self-reliant than it had been in the past. And so we see this with everything from the community-supported agriculture to permaculture to the slow food movement and on and on. I think that this is really one place where the commons and localism is going to advance. The other notable one is the transition town movement, of people trying to anticipate peak oil and climate change by making their communities more economically and socially self-reliant.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with commoner and common scholar David Bollier about his new book, Think Like a Commoner, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons. Now, you mentioned a farmer's market before. You know, the idea of the commons is that people are self-organizing things that they get for free, and this includes the digital commons, things like Linux, which you mentioned, the whole development of Linux open source software. On the other hand, there are things like farmers markets and cooperatives where money is exchanged. What kind of mechanism or laws are common to both these forms where they can work together in a way that is comfortable for both of them?
The core issue is the long-term sustainability of the commons, which is about relationships more than it's about transactions. The market is chiefly, especially in our time, is about impersonal, one-off, episodic transactions, whereas a commons is about social relationships and the integrity of the whole. So if we're going to have a commons work with a market work with a commons, it needs to be accountable to it and responsive to it, and not let the money, the love of money or the private interest in money and private profit dominate at the expense of everything else. So it becomes very tricky to navigate a relationship between the commons and the market. But it is perfectly possible to do so, as we've seen with Linux, a free, meaning no-cost, open-source software that is also packaged and sold as a product, and people make money by providing technical support to it. So in a local circumstance as well, we need to have principles that assert the community interests prevail over the market, but market exchange, as in farmers markets and the like, perform many important functions as well. It's just that we don't want too big of a player or the money dictating everything else. So that's really an ongoing structural challenge with any commons.
You've been engaged in the last few years in developing an international legal basis to underpin the commons. Tell us a little bit about your efforts in that and how that helps people think like commoners.
Well, there's a long tradition going back to the Magna Carta and the companion document that's often not remembered, the Charter of the Forest, which protects commoners' rights. Essentially, it protected the right, all of our rights to subsistence, to live, which I might say in the market economy, we don't have that right, because if you don't have the money, you often can't have your basic needs for water, for food, for shelter met. But under the Magna Carta, certain principles of having access to common resources such as the forest and water and pastures and so forth was protected as a matter of law. Many of these non-market legal protections have been forgotten or deliberately eclipsed. I recently wrote a book called Green Governance, Ecological Survival, Human Rights, and the Law of the Commons to recover this body of law that's commons-based. And I think part of our challenge today is to devise new types of law, both social and statutory and conventional, to protect commons rights, the rights of commoners, meaning the ability of people to come together, to self-organize, to create their own rules for resources that matter to them, be it on the internet, be it in their local context, be it ecological.
And yet everywhere we look, it seems like the opposite is happening, at least at the macro level. You know, I'm thinking of the digital commons. I mean, really, the internet was probably the most incredible modern commons ever created. It was and gave rise to just the kind of self-governance and innovation that you talk about in your book, Thinking Like a Commoner. And yet it seems more and more it has become enclosed or is being enclosed. First of all, define enclosure and talk a little bit about this process of enclosure and how we can move against it. I mean, is it inevitable that capital is just going to try to crowd out the commons wherever it can?
Well, enclosure is the process by which investors, corporations, capital, essentially, tries to commodify and privatize resources that belong to us all. And the term got its start really in the English enclosure movement, where the landed gentry took over pastures to use them for breeding sheep so they could create more wool for the export market. So it's essentially about the marketization of things that should not necessarily be marketized. And the Internet is, of course, because so much value is created by commenting, by people coming together, be it in Wikipedia or open access scientific journals or free software. So just there's so many things that capital sees this as a cheap source of value. And if they can just get their arms around it by putting it in private property rights or controlling access to the Internet the way the telecom and cable companies do, they can enclose the value created by the Internet. Well, the story's not over on the Internet by any means, because I think there's some rather fierce backlash and assertion of rights by commoners of all sorts. And I think the value created by distributed individuals coming together to create their own rules, not only the value but the functionality of that kind of behavior, is really starting to marginalize markets. Commons are out-competing or out-cooperating certain markets because it's simply easier, more efficient, and more socially satisfying to do things as a shared community rather than as a market. So I think that that story is not over, but you're right to point to this tension. There's a very deep structural tension between those who want to privatize and marketize the commons and those commoners who are trying to protect it. The language of the commons and enclosure helps us begin to have a vocabulary for naming and fighting this process.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with commons scholar and advocate David Bollier about his latest book, Think Like a Commoner.
You mentioned before that the commons is a new vision of development, and we talked about the women who had this seed bank, I guess you would call it, in India. Give us some other examples of things that are happening. I think you mentioned the Zapatistas and the Potato Park in Peru. Tell us a little bit about those or some other examples that you think really show how this is an alternative vision for development.
Well, in Peru, or as in many places around the world, a lot of multinational companies, especially agricultural biotech companies, are trying to plunder the genetic diversity to create patented products, be they seeds or drugs or whatever. And it was a very rare instance where a number of indigenous peoples in Peru now have official legal control over what they call their agro-ethnobotanical knowledge, a landscape, meaning the diversity of more than 900 different types, species of potatoes, which their ancestors have bred over generations. Well, they wanted to protect that from so-called biopiracy, where a first world company would come in and claim the genetic knowledge, patent it, make it proprietary, and then require people to pay for what had previously been a shared resource. So I find that a really optimistic, hopeful scenario that many indigenous peoples and traditional societies are starting to recognize that their commoning needs to be protected and they need to begin to acquire a legal basis for it. In South Africa, a lot of traditional communities are developing what are called biocultural protocols, BCPs, which they're using to fight trade treaties, saying, no, our means of protecting our livelihood and raising food and protecting our community identity has a legal standing that has to be put up against trade treaties, which would otherwise claim that's an unfair trade practice. So those are two examples. But I think domestically it's important to talk about the many, many commons we have in our midst. And we can talk about things like we've mentioned open source software, but there's a whole open design and hardware movement which are trying to create automobiles and furniture and agricultural farm equipment based on open source principles, meaning the equipment is inexpensive, locally sourceable, modular, easy to modify and design, and not proprietary. And so we see a lot of these things popping up. We see the whole 3D printing maker movement. And there's so many interesting offshoots, like there's an open prosthetics project, which is using open source principles to create all sorts of innovative prosthetics for people who have disabilities. So the digital world is one really robust area for commenting, but I think we also see it in a lot of movements focused on localism, the cooperative movement, the transition town movement I mentioned, the social and solidarity economy movement. In Europe, there's something called the degrowth movement, which is quite consciously trying to develop frameworks for developing, meeting our needs economically without it requiring constant, endless economic growth, which is really the pathology of capitalism in our time. So there's just a wealth of diverse commons out there. You know, I haven't mentioned alternative currencies or the hospitality commons known as couch surfing, where you can go to dozens of different countries and crash on someone's couch. You know, blood banks or organ banks are types of commons. So this should give you an idea, even within modern industrial societies, the prevalence of commoning is quite active.
And finally, if you wanted to sum up for somebody what it meant to think like a commoner, what would be your, you know, one or two or three talking points or phrases?
Well, to think like a commoner is to realize that you can meet your needs by developing the relationships with others who are similarly situated, devise the systems for protecting those interests over time. It's about stewardship of the resource and your community, not private property and ownership. And it's about negotiating with the market from that position so that the useful things the market can do can still serve the community and not begin to overwhelm the community, as in enclosures of the commons. Thinking like a commoner begins to radiate out into all these many different rich spheres of activity, and you soon start to cultivate a different perspective, not only on traditional government and social transformation, but on your own identity and how you relate to people in meeting your needs. And I would just point to this really still somewhat under the radar world of lots of commons projects that really are starting to remake the world, especially in Europe and the global south, where the commons is quite active and expanding.
And our listeners can read a lot more about those projects and learn to think like a commoner by reading your book, Think Like a Commoner, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons. David Bollier, thanks so much for coming back on this show. Your work is so exciting and so important. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed being here again.
David Bollier. Read an excerpt from Think Like a Commoner at writersvoice.net. You can also find links to our other interviews with Bollier about his other books about the commons. Next up is A Local Sustainable Revolution in Our Future. Stay tuned after the break for the answer.
Sometimes all we need is a spark. Global block. Ground zero. I take money from the rich and invest it in the poor. Been a long time coming, time we settle the score. You could do it for your people, but I do it for you all. And yes, I got mines covered and I never let them fall. When the real hits the fan, son, who you gonna call? Not Ron Paul, more like the Honorable Rhythm Martinez with a team of superheroes. Walk throughout the land by my team of super zeros. Add it up, come back with negative indictments of a system that stomped out positive enlightenment. Occupy the streets as occupy the nation, but don't occupy your mind with false occupations. Occupy the positions when your team falls short. Stand with the accused by occupying the court. Occupy all airwaves and spaces in between. Occupy the undercover and the overseen. But when occupying ain't enough, and we need a next tactic. Combine the global block math and see what happens. We do it for the people, we do it for the movement. Occupy America, that's what we do.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Local businesses comprise more than half the U.S. economy by output and jobs, and the vast majority of those are small or medium businesses. Yet 98% of the U.S. public is not allowed to invest in these businesses, even though they tend to be highly profitable. And being local, they're often more accountable to the needs of their communities than national or international companies. Michael Schumann wants it to be easier for local folks to invest in their local economy. His new book, Local Dollars, Local Sense, that's S-E-N-S-E, is a roadmap to local investing. He shows how individuals and groups can invest locally right now, but he also says the system has to change to bring about a real local investment revolution. That's because, Schumann says, we live under a system of investor apartheid that throws up insurmountable barriers to that revolution. I asked him to explain.
What happened was we created a system of securities laws back in the 1930s, as did many other countries. And the securities laws really are a system of investor apartheid. If you are in the top 1 to 2% of income earners or wealth holders, you are allowed to invest in anyone, anytime, no questions asked. If you're in the other 98 to 99%, you may only put a penny into a business that has done significant legal disclosure documents. And these documents tend to be, you know, 100 or 200 pages long, often written in 8-point font, all caps kinds of lettering. These are the things that no human being has ever been observed to read. And really, as you read through them, every single page says some variation of, you will lose everything. Well, these kinds of empty disclosures can cost you $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 of a lawyer's time. And because of that exorbitant legal expense, very, very few local businesses have gone through the process to allow themselves to be invested in by the so-called unaccredited investors.
So, in fact, what this means is that only big companies go through this procedure, and then only people who have, what is it, $1 million worth of wealth outside their primary residence or make over $300,000 a year are actually allowed to invest?
If you, again, are in that very wealthy top 1 to 2%, and what it means in specific terms is that you as an individual are earning $200,000 a year or more, or as a couple, $300,000 a year, or your household has $1 million in wealth, excluding your house. Okay, so those are the specific criteria. And if you meet any of those criteria, you are allowed to invest basically in anything. If you are below that threshold, only if the company does extensive legal work could you put your money in there. So most companies start out, you know, being private placements that only wealthy people can put their money in. And a few that, say, go on to the New York Stock Exchange do the kinds of legal disclosures that allow unaccredited investors to participate.
You point out in this book, Local Dollars, Local Sense, that the way this system is set up, it even forces companies that make good by doing good, like Ben & Jerry's, for example, they are forced to sell out to the big guys, just like Ben & Jerry's had to sell out to Unilever. Connect the dots on that for us.
Right. Well, so first of all, let's point out that Ben & Jerry's, in the early stage of the company, did something very good. They created an unusual direct public offering in the first stages of the company, where you had to be a resident in Vermont in order to put money into the company. And the idea was that even though it would be a publicly traded company, that the shares would be restricted to the state of Vermont and thereby keeping the company local. And frankly, if they had continued to keep that structure of the company, they never would have been hostily taken over by Unilever. But because they let go of that and transformed themselves into a more traditional publicly traded company where people all across the world, not just across the country, held shares of the company, they then became vulnerable to a hostile takeover. So it really shows, I think, that figuring out a good strategy for holding on to local ownership is a way of keeping a company anchored in the community and making sure that it continues to generate long-term economic development benefits for that community.
Now, you call this whole system, the way it's set up, a huge market failure, because not only is it hurting local businesses by starving them of capital, and that's been a real problem since the financial meltdown. I mean, banks are just not lending to local businesses. But you also say evidence suggests that they are remarkably profitable and competitive, so that, in fact, investors are being forced to invest in a highly risky, derivatives-based, casino economy on the one hand, and are being prohibited from investing in, the kind of businesses that could actually give them a real return.
Absolutely. And this is, frankly, a huge fraud that has been perpetrated on the American people in the name of protecting them. I would say the problem goes back to the way in which we perceive investment opportunities out there. When you ask most Americans, what is the profitable economy? What are the things you want to put your money into? Well, people always talk about the stock market. And one of the things I do in the book is I show in the very beginning that if you use the best data about the historic performance of the stock market, which if you go to the website of Robert Shiller, who's an economics professor at Yale, and he shared the Nobel Prize in economics last year. But he has data that if you dutifully add dividends, remove inflation, you find that the typical 12-month return, annual return on Wall Street securities has been about 2.6%. And frankly, that is a pathetic rate of return compared to what you can get in a lot of local businesses. Now, one other thing that I do when I go talk with groups is I ask people, by show of hands, how many people here have bought something locally over the last week? And, usually because they've come to hear me and they know I'm talking about local business and local economies, all the hands go up. Then I ask how many people do their banking at a local bank or credit union. Usually most of the hands go up. And then I say, those with pension funds, how many of you are putting at least 1% into local business? And at this point, I've already pointed out that local businesses are more than half the economy, highly competitive and highly profitable. And at that point, you see no hands. And that's the nature of the market failure. Because we've structured this system so that all of us are systematically overinvesting in Wall Street securities, which represent, frankly, a rather unprofitable, highly unconnected piece of the economy, unconnected with social well-being and community well-being. We're putting all of our money into there, and none of our money into local businesses, which have the closest connection with economic and community well-being.
Well, I can hear the voices now saying, but wait a second, Wall Street is at historic highs. It's never been like this. If you'd invested back in 2009 when it was at the low, you'd be rolling in dough right now.
Well, you can always pick two numbers in hindsight representing when you bought and when you sold so that you look like you were a total genius. The numbers that I've given you are, in fact, the accurate historic averages. But let's set that aside and just focus on the relative performance of local small business. If you look at statistics that are available or used to be available in Statistical Abstract, which the Department of Commerce would publish, You found that sole proprietorships, which most small businesses either are or start out as, are three times as profitable as C corporations, with partnerships falling somewhere in between. If you look at data in Canada, which are a little bit more fine-tuned than data you can find in the U.S., you find that the most profitable companies have 10 to 20 employees, and that the companies that you buy on the Toronto Stock Exchange have about two-thirds of the profitability of those smaller companies. So there's lots of evidence that small companies are, in fact, the best bets. And one of the mistakes that people also make is they assume when you're talking about small business, you're investing in startup businesses. But no one said anything about startups. The key sweet spot for a local investor is to put their money into well-established local businesses with strong, steady growth.
What would that actually mean? I mean, at this point, you've said it's almost impossible to do that. And yet there are ways in this book, in Local Dollars, Local Cents, where there are already some ways that are available to people. I want to actually start out by asking about one that is controversial, and that is the idea of allowing crowdsourcing of local businesses, something that Obama seems to support or has talked about. Crowdsourcing for local businesses, allowing it on the internet. And there are companies who are now positioning themselves as brokers to be able to do this. What is the protection for your, you know, everyday investor, everyday person to invest in these without getting ripped off?
So there's a lot in there. And let me just say, first of all, that I think that the crowdfunding reforms that were passed by Congress and the Obama administration signed 2 years ago, which are just coming into effect now, are a very significant improvement over the securities laws problems that we talked about just a few minutes ago. And it's also worth saying that crowdfunding, you know, it has no legal meaning, but basically, conceptually, it means many people putting small amounts of money into something. And really, crowdfunding has, let's say, four different flavors. So one flavor of crowdfunding is where people donate money through, say, Kickstarter or Indiegogo, and in return for their donations, they receive a T-shirt. This has no securities implications. And you might even say this is a dodge of securities laws, because from as far as the securities regulators are concerned, the T-shirt is not a return on your investment. If you put money in Kiva, Kiva lends money to entrepreneurs, often in the global south, sometimes in the north, and you just get your principal paid back without interest. Well, that also is not regarded as a security. So Kiva is another creative dodge of securities laws. Then you get to sites like the Lending Club or Prosper, and then they do pay interest on loans that are crowdsourced. Well, in order to do that and to allow unaccredited investors to put money into them, these sites have had to do literally millions of dollars of securities work to facilitate this. So that's why the unaccredited investor is allowed to participate. The last category, which is where people might be able to put small amounts of money as equity investments or perhaps as royalty investments into small businesses, this is the piece that is going to be allowed under the Jobs Act, which, as I said, is just coming into effect this year in 2014. Now, you asked the question, what is the way that you can assure people that they're not going to be scammed? And this kind of leads back to one of my frustrations and concerns with the Jobs Act, which is that the Jobs Act is, in a sense, overly broad. It allowed everyone in the country to put small amounts of money into any company in the country. And probably it would have been smarter to just do this on a state-by-state basis, allow anyone in a state to put money into a small company with lighter regulation. So my advice to anyone listening to this interview is by the end of 2014, your inbox is going to be besieged with requests by companies that you think about going to this or that website and investing in them. And my advice to you is to delete all of them. We should really systematically focus our money on companies in our own communities that we know and we trust, because ultimately the best way of protecting yourself against fraud is not relying on any pieces of paper, but instead to talk with the manager, talk with the workforce, experience the good or the service, and really do your own sense of due diligence and ground truthing.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Michael Schumann about his latest book, Local Dollars, Local Sense, and that's S-E-N-S-E, How to Shift Your Money from Wall Street to Main Street and Achieve Real Prosperity. So now let's talk about some of the ways that people can do this. I mean, I think you've made the case for why we need to do this. I think one of the first things you talk about are cooperatives. How can people invest in local cooperatives?
Cooperatives have been an interesting option for people who are interested in putting money in their community, and it's been around for quite a while. And it turns out that cooperatives are almost entirely regulated at the state level. And most states define cooperative memberships not as securities. So that means that it is relatively easy for a group of unaccredited consumers to come together, put together a cooperative, which basically means pooling their capital and then doing something, you know, whether it's creating a utility or a grocery store or a cooperative bank and making it benefit all of the members. Now, when a co-op takes a loan from its members, so many bigger co-ops will do this, say, when they have a capital project. So, for example, the Weaver Street Market, which is a big grocery co-op in Carrboro, North Carolina, when they wanted to build their third store, they decided to borrow $1 million from their members. Well, that is a security. But because co-ops have this sort of ethos of solidarity where they share things with one another, co-ops have been happy to share their legal papers with one another and thereby bring down the costs a little bit of doing the legal declarations necessary to allow unaccredited members of a co-op to, say, invest in a loan. So that's one way that co-ops have done investing. Another model that's interesting is in Western Massachusetts, there's a co-op called Co-op Power. And the members of Co-op Power each put in $1,000, and that money gets pooled to then, in turn, invest in other kinds of local energy businesses. So solar installation, energy-efficient appliances, wood chips, biofuels. And as long as under 40% of the member capital is being invested, the co-op will not be considered an investment company and you're home free. So that's another kind of strategy that a co-op could use.
Wow, that's really interesting. You also talk about institutional lending. You say it's the cutting edge of business borrowing. You know, you have special CDs, slow munis. Explain what these are. What's institutional lending in local business?
So two different kinds of institutions that you're referring to there. So the first institution might be a local bank or a credit union. And, you know, the truth is that local banks are much more likely to put their capital into the hands of local business than bigger banks. So that's one reason why people should, as Arianna Huffington encouraged them to do, move their money. But even if people moved all their money, honestly, credit unions, banks are very, very conservative animals. They have to be. They want to make sure their business loans are as collateralized as possible. So what some people have done is said, you know what, we're going to go to the bank and we're going to say, we're going to create a new pool of money for you, and we're going to put our money entirely at risk, and then we're going to tell you, the bank, where we want that money invested. And if the investment does well, great, you get your fees, we get money back. If the investment does poorly, you get your fees, and your loss is completely covered. Well, banks have thought, you know, this is not such a bad idea. And give you a specific example of this. Equal Exchange, which is a fair trade coffee company, worker run in Boston, they approached their local bank, Wainwright, and they convinced them to create special certificates of deposit around fair trade. Now, it ultimately was understood by people in Wainwright that if they put their money into this particular fund, the only place it would go would be to Equal Exchange. So as a result of this, Equal Exchange has a $1 million line of credit because of these targeted certificates of deposit.
And
the other institutional thing you mentioned, and I talk about in the book, is creative use of municipal bonds. Municipal bonds have been used for all kinds of really dumb economic development projects for years. And municipal bonds have the legal characteristic that the income that you get on the bonds may be tax-free. So that's seen as a real plus. And the municipal bonds are usually issued for things like big industrial development parks or big corporate attractions. And there's no reason we could not start using municipal bonds to create funds within a city that would support directly or indirectly finance of certain targeted local business. And you can see the beginnings of this starting to happen in, say, a state like Massachusetts, which has a program of green bonds. And the proceeds of those green bonds are now used to support small-scale energy production and small-scale water efficiency and stormwater protection and, you know, those kinds of infrastructure adjustments. So I think, you know, we're going to see a real expansion in the use of municipal bonds in the years ahead.
Michael Schumann, you also talk about something you call the holy grail for local investing, the creation of local exchanges, and maybe add to that also the idea of a revolving loan fund. These would be opportunities for local investors to pool their money, in some sense, to supplant mutual funds.
What I would say is that the local investment revolution ahead is going to require at least four different kinds of steps, four different kinds of reforms. So we have to make it easier and cheaper for small businesses to issue securities that unaccredited investors can put their money into. So that's number one. Number two, we have to make it easier and cheaper for people who hold those securities to buy and sell them on exchanges. Number three, we have to make it easier and cheaper for unaccredited investors to put their securities in a pool, in a fund. And number four, we've got to improve the laws around institutional investing, by which I mean things like universities or churches or pension funds, and make it clear that if the custodians of those funds want to put money into local businesses, they can do so without violating their fiduciary responsibilities. Now, I mentioned those four steps in that order because really they have to follow that order. That is to say, you can't establish that a fiduciary is doing a good job unless the funds in which the, say, pension fund are going to put their money into, that those underlying funds have a good track record. those funds are never going to have a good track record unless the securities within them can be traded. That is, that the market is liquid. You can't get liquidity in a stock market unless you have a critical mass of stocks. So really, we're at the very beginning of this journey. With the Jobs Act, we've begun to make it somewhat easier and cheaper for people to hold securities. And by the end of this year, companies like Mission Markets will be creating community portals to make it cheaper and easier for people to at least do primary sales of these securities. Secondary sales are going to be a little bit harder, and that's going to be the next step in all of this. And funds, well, we've got a lot of work to do before community funds become a lot more present.
Your emphasis is local, but you mentioned the company Equal Exchange. They engage in an international trade, it's fair trade. What are your thoughts on some globalized trade? Do you feel like an economy needs to be all local? What is the integration of different levels that you could see on a sustainable basis?
In my view, the evidence suggests that the strongest community is going to, number one, have the highest percentage of its jobs in locally owned businesses, and number two, that those businesses will attempt to sell as much as they can locally, which increases local self-reliance, and as much as they can globally. So there is no contradiction to a locally owned company selling stuff out of market if the economy of scale is such that they're competitive. And so coffee growing is and coffee roasting and coffee selling is probably an area like that because, you know, it's not going to be soon, even with global warming, that most U.S. cities are going to be robust coffee growers.
That's right. And just a final question, if somebody wants to start investing locally, what would be your number one piece of advice to them?
Number one, get out of credit cards. Number two, put the money in your home. When you have no mortgage, and if you totally paid off your house and you've bought your kids a house, then it might make sense for you to start putting money into the market.
Well, that is great advice, and this is just a great book, very engagingly written as well. Michael Schumann, thank you so much for talking to us about Local Dollars, Local Cents.
My pleasure.
Michael Schumann is a leading expert on community economics. In addition to Local Dollars, Local Cents, he's written numerous books on the subject, including The Small Mart Revolution. He's a founder of BALLI, Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, and a fellow with the Post Carbon Institute. And you know the deal. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Local Dollars, Local Cents. And also for Earth Day, you'll find a link to an excerpt from my hour with poet and organic farmer Scott Chaskey about his new book, Seed Time. We'll hear the full hour in May. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.